8:29 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, spring finally appears to be in full swing, but with the heavy snow year, Park City residents may be in for a serious spring runoff season. Here to talk about the potential for flooding and how to prepare, I have Park City Streets Manager Troy Daly, along with Emergency Manager Mike McComb. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So a very good winter for our snowpack. Warmer temperatures have caused a lot of lower elevation snow to disappear. Are we already seeing issues with flooding, Mike?
We are not currently. We're seeing what appears to be the start of a good orderly runoff season, which is good news for us. And speaking with National Weather Service the past couple of days, this current round of heating that we're seeing starting yesterday and going through the weekend is really advantageous for us, melting off some of those lower to mid-level snowpack levels and really helping us to kind of progress through the season in an orderly fashion.
Yeah, so have we seen any kind of, concerned areas that you're concerned about at this point?
We have some areas that we watch, we monitor, about 27 points that we check twice a day, every day, throughout the next probably 6 weeks or so, throughout the spring runoff. And these are areas that are screens, grates that collect debris, and we want to make sure those are clean, make sure that there's no debris floating down that can get stuck in pipes or obstruct the flow of water. But we have not seen any problem areas other than just some debris that floats down. An example would be the shoe tree. Over the winter, a lot of shoes fall out of that tree, and they end up down in the screen down at Iron Horse Drive in Bonanza. So we'll pull those out quite often throughout the next few weeks.
Yeah. So is that what you are really most concerned about, the creek that comes out of Daly Canyon?
The creek that comes out of Daly Canyon, yes, that's one of many. All these streams, White Pine Canyon is another one that we've got quite a bit of water coming out of. And we just monitor all those crossings and make sure that the water is able to flow through.
Yeah. What areas of town are most likely impacted by flooding? I mean, I know people in Prospector have sump pumps going.
And it would be a good year this spring to check those sump pumps, make sure they're in working order. We haven't needed them in a few years, or at least last spring. But anywhere there's a ditch is potential for problems if that ditch is obstructed or a ditch or a stream.
Yeah. What about here in Old Town? Because, I don't know, were you guys back here in, what was it, 83 when we saw the creek flood daily?
I was not here when that happened, but since then we put a new conduit in, that's a new pipe system behind those houses that are in front of those houses that allow the water to flow through. So we've improved the system a lot. And then also, what, 2.5-3 years ago, we started a stormwater utility, and we've had the opportunity to go out and clean over 11 miles of pipe. And some of that pipe was 50% obstructed with sediment. So our system is in a lot better shape today than it was even just 2 years ago.
Yeah. I also see there on the Poison Creek bike path, walking path, lots of sandbags. Are those out already again?
We will put sandbags where we know has been minor problems. We've seen some of the residents come in and gather sandbags. Those are the residents who have, seems like they come in every year and get the same amount of sandbags and sandbag the same area, regardless whether it's an average snowpack or an above average snowpack. So it seems like we've given out quite a few sandbags, but not any more than a normal year. We have sandbags ready. We have some filled. We have loads of sand ready to go and a lot of empties. If we need that, we don't anticipate it, but we're ready if we need it.
Yeah. We'll get back to the sandbags, but along the creek, why not just deepen the creek in some of those places we know that it spills over onto the path?
That's one thought, but it's only a short period of time and not even every year, so I mean, we could do that. The willows are there to kind of help with bank stabilization, but at the same time, those willows will obstruct flows. So it's a good and a bad thing having those willows, and it tends to allow sediment to build up in those streams, which lowers the depth of those ditches and streams.
Okay, well, as you kind of mentioned, we do have a sandbag program. How does that work?
Well, residents can come in at 1053 Iron Horse Drive, or they can call 615-5301 and ask the receptionist about sandbags. They can come in and they're allowed to get 25 sandbags free. After that, there's a nominal fee, and that's just mostly to prevent hoarding of sandbags. And then if we do run into problems, we will deploy our efforts. But as far as preparation, they can come in and gather sandbags if they want.
Okay. Do they have to fill them too, or you do that?
We fill the first 25.
Okay. Okay.
And then, Leslie, I'd add that Summit County also has a program where their public works also provides sandbags to Summit County residents.
Okay. Let's talk about roads, I mean, and how the water impacts that. Do you see flooding on the streets themselves?
The only time I've seen flooding on the streets, there was two areas, one on Thames Canyon Drive where that would flood out onto the into the gutter and then go down to the next inlet box. And since that time, we was able to clean that culvert, so I don't anticipate that going into the, not in the street, but into the gutter. The other area was on Bonanza, where I referred to as the shoes getting stuck. Since then, we've also improved that. When we built the tunnel, we improved that connection. So I don't anticipate water going into the roads really anywhere.
Okay. Have you put your road plan together, Troy, in terms of what's going to get fixed here? I noticed along Little Kate that kind of problem areas were marked, but that was the only place I've seen that.
So our efforts right now have been on Lucky John, some on Little Kate. Right now we're on Three Kings Drive doing some work on that. We've got our plan together, our pavement management plan. We hope to take it to council next week for approval of some contracts. A lot of what we've seen with the freeze-thaw, the amount of water that we had last year, it really caused havoc to some of our roads. We've seen failures in places we've not seen failures before. So our crews are actively out digging those areas up, and we're working on fixing those. And our pavement management program that will start in July, that'll do a lot of work for pavement preservation.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have the report in front of you, but I noticed driving into the Cook Drive, Stryker Avenue area, those roads were really poor shape.
Those roads are on the docket to get milled and paved this year.
Okay, and then notice that you had been able to fix the big pothole there as you kind of pull out of Heber Avenue onto Deer Valley Drive. That took some digging there, huh?
We did it correct this time. We went all the way down to the base and build off that. So,
okay. Any other precautions that you think people should take during this potential for flooding?
Well, so I think just keeping an eye on local conditions. Certainly property owners can go monitor areas where they know that they've seen some flooding in the past and take precautionary measures, clearing out obstructions. If someone has, you know, kind of altered the stream course by adding a couple extra decorative rocks, maybe now is the time to move those out of the way. Of course, we want people to be safe when they're doing this. During the runoff season, we do get higher flows and higher levels, and certainly that water is cold. So want to make sure that that we're keeping pets and small children away from the waters and try and avoid a tragedy that doesn't need to happen.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add, Troy?
No, thank you.
Okay. Troy Daly and Mike McComb, thanks for your time this
thank
morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie.
Right now, it's 8:39. Mindfulness instructor Rebecca Brenner offering a new 6-week series on mindfulness and compassion. It starts this month. It'll be held at the Park City Library. She joins me now in the studio with details. Good morning.
Good morning.
Actually, I said this month, but I really don't know what the dates are.
It's May 7th okay. through June 11th, Tuesday evening, 6:30 to 8 o'clock.
Okay. And it is at the Park City Library in which room?
201.
Okay. And how much is it?
It's $225. And it's 6 weeks, like I said, each Tuesday evening. And we're going to be looking at sort of the foundations of mindfulness, like attention and awareness. But we're also going to bring in the importance of compassion and what compassion looks like on a day-to-day practice with your mindfulness practices as well.
Okay. So is this for beginners or is this for people who already have an established practice? Or
it's for everybody. It's for all levels.
Okay. And what do you think people can get out of it?
Well, a lot of times when we come to mindfulness, we're learning about being present. And sometimes a lot of the focus is on that. Be present, be present, be present. But a lot of times when we start to learn how to be skillfully present, a lot comes up. We start to see a lot more clearly in our own minds, our own hearts. We see some challenges maybe in our relationships, our work. And so compassion really is the fuel that allows us to sustain our attention on what is, because without compassion for what we're finding, we might want to turn away or run or overwork or overeat or whatever ways that we try to escape from what actually is.
Right. Can you talk to us a little bit about the differences then between what you call mindfulness and meditation?
Yeah, so mindfulness, meditation is kind of a catch-all word because there's all sorts of different meditations that can include visualizations, relaxation, that come from all sorts of different lineages, or even that can be housed within a religious content. And mindfulness is a really specific cognitive skill that we're developing. So it's this practice of finding our capacity to have conscious volition over our attention. And so again and again and again and again, we're noticing when we've lost that volition, we've gone into that default mode of being caught up in thinking. And then we practice like a push-up, bringing our attention out of that river of thinking and back into the present moment.
So we know we've lost it kind of like when we can't stop eating the jelly beans.
Yeah, or watching, you know, I'll just watch the next show. No, the next show, you know, and then 2.5 hours later, you've gone through the whole season.
Yeah. Is this a practice time as well? I mean, or is it more of a lecture? I mean, how is it formatted?
Yeah, so it'll be mostly practice. So students, I'm going to ask them to bring a journal and we'll be doing journaling and discussion, but a lot of practicing. So finding ways that they can practice mindfulness and then bring in components of compassion to their mindfulness practice. And what's really important to me as a student of mindfulness, as well as a teacher, is to have ways to then do that in my everyday life. So it's not just something that happens for 5 or 10 minutes on a cushion before I go to bed, but it happens in my relationships, my parenting, my work. And so I want to be able to share that with students so that they feel really confident at the end of the 6 weeks in ways that they can bring mindfulness and compassion into their everyday experience.
So using the example of kind of binge watching, where does the compassion come into that?
Yeah, so compassion, like mindfulness, it's a process. And if we really are practicing, it's a lifelong process. So something like if we binge on something, sometimes it might be that you go ahead and binge, and then at the end of it, it's like, oh, it's okay. I'm struggling. I have A, B, and C happening, and I needed this way to kind of check out. But then maybe eventually as you keep practicing, you can catch yourself before you get lost in a binge, right? It's like, oh, I'm suffering, and instead of numbing out, I'm going to bring a lot of compassion and presence to my suffering, and I'm going to let myself be with it for a few moments. And then maybe down the line, it's I can be with it for half an hour. Maybe I can be with it for an hour and really start to bring compassion and clear seeing to why we want to check out. Like what's happening inside of us that makes us want to check out, and to really kind of get at the root of it instead of soothing ourselves with something just to make it through.
Yeah, that's the hard part.
That's right? The hard part.
Right? Because like you say, sometimes it's like it's so uncomfortable that, you know, it's easier to push it away.
Yeah, and I think that we are wired to want to push it away. But the thing that's really interesting to me about mindfulness and compassion is that we also have wiring to be present and compassionate with our suffering. But we live in a world where we're not really taught how to do that. We live in a world where soothing is really encouraged. And so mindfulness, we can discover that we actually do have this inherent capacity to be with the things that we want to check out. And what that does for us when we can learn how to be with our struggles, it creates a deeper sense of well-being, because then we feel as students like, oh, this is really hard, but I can be with what's hard. I don't have to leave. I can be with this. And that gives us courage and strength and peace.
Okay. So you have, I know, been offering courses out of the hospital, but moving it to the library this time.
Yeah, just trying something different and branching out into the community a little bit more.
Okay. So if people are interested in registering?
They can reach out through my website, rebeccabrenner.com, and there's a contact form there that they can just fill out, and I'll get it through my email.
Okay, so it's starting May 7th and running through June 11th. And the time again?
Tuesdays from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the library in room 201.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
That's it. Thanks so much, Leslie.
Okay, Rebecca, thank you. More than 600 cases of measles have been confirmed in 22 states, several of those surrounding Utah. It's the second largest number of cases reported in the U.S. since measles was eliminated in 2000. In the studio to tell us a little bit more about how to protect yourself, I have Summit County Health Department nurse Carolyn Rose. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, no cases yet in Utah.
No cases yet in Utah, thankfully. But yeah. I won't be surprised when we see the first one.
Yeah, because kind of what I've heard is we're just really one plane ride away from it.
We are. We are. And so far from what I have read, all of the outbreaks are from someone who has traveled over to areas in Europe and other places that are currently having outbreaks of measles and bringing them back.
Okay. So what causes the outbreaks? I mean, is it...
Unimmunized people is the whole cause of the outbreaks. There are some very small percentages of people who may have either had the disease or been vaccinated with two doses of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. However, it's highly contagious, and that is part of the problem. It stays alive for 2 hours, after someone's in the room, so the chances of someone having measles and exposing others is really highly likely. And they are contagious for 4 days before and 4 days after the rash. And the rash doesn't even start until after the person gets ill initially. So it's just so highly contagious, and that is why the outbreaks are happening amongst mostly unimmunized people.
Mm-hmm. So the symptoms are, it's kind of flu-like?
Yeah, high temperature, runny nose, red watery eyes, and then that will subside, and then a couple of days later then the rash appears, usually starts around the head, neck, and goes into the trunk and the rest of the body, and then that will last for about 5 or 6 days.
Yeah, so what's so bad about the measles?
It can cause brain encephalitis, which is infection in the brain, and death. So Okay. Those are pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. There's some of us at that age that got through it just fine. But
right. And I did, too. You know, I'm of that age that I had both kinds of measles. But I think because of vaccines doing their job, we have not really seen the number of hospitalized and the number of deaths as we saw before the vaccines. And I was reading an article by Lori Freeman, who is the CEO of the National Association of City and County Health Officials, yesterday, and I thought that what she had to say was really good. She said, you know, most Americans don't remember the dangerous impact of these diseases, which most of us don't. I mean, even I don't. And that have been made so rare now because people are getting vaccinated. And so we've allowed the fear of the vaccine to displace the fear of the illness. And I think that's really true with most of the vaccine-preventable diseases. We don't see them. We never, you know, even as kids when you and I had it, we got through it fine, but we also didn't know about the hospitalized cases and the deaths that occurred.
Right. So the vaccine, and that's part of the problem, is that it requires two vaccines to be effective.
Correct.
And so some have only received one.
Right.
And again, that's another age group that we're saying?
Correct. So your first dose is given between 12 and 15 months of age, so the babies. And then there's a booster dose, which actually isn't a booster dose. It just makes your body more defensive against the diseases between ages 4 and 6. So that's about kindergarten. People born during and after 1957 are not considered to have any natural immunity. And so there's several ways that you can know if you're immune. You can go to your doctor and ask for a titer, or you can just go in if you've never had all these diseases, or you don't know if you've had the diseases, just go in and get the MMR vaccine. A second dose followed 28 days after the first.
Okay, what's a titer?
Sorry, a titer is, it just shows the level of antibodies or the level of immunity that you may or may not have.
Okay. If you have had it, though, it's safe to say that you don't need a booster or anything like that?
If you were born before 1957, yes.
Okay. Let's see. Now, that vaccine is also, so it's the measles, mumps, and rubella.
Correct.
Rubella is a second form of measles?
Right. They used to call it, I don't know, the...
Well, the racist form, the German measles, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, or the red measles was the seven-day one. So rubella is not, you don't get as ill with that. It's the three-day measles. However, if a pregnant woman, and you were correct in asking me about... A pregnant woman who comes in contact with the virus and has never had it, has no immunity to it, it can cause birth defects.
So usually, I mean, if you're thinking of that you're going to get pregnant, it's but make sure that you've got the boost or the vaccine.
If it was me, mm-hmm. I probably would. I worry because there's so many childbearing age women out there who may not have been vaccinated because their parents chose not to vaccinate them. And so, you know, with the recurrence of all these vaccine-preventable diseases, I'm fearful for those childbearing age women and what could happen with their pregnancy. It's sad.
Are we hearing anything about the mumps?
A little bit, yes. There's a couple small outbreaks, not in Summit County. But yes, we have had a little resurgence of that. It's been in communities that are against vaccines.
Okay. Anything that the county health department is doing in response to this?
Well, you know, people call, they ask questions. We always encourage it. We're getting more questions from people who have not been vaccinated, or there was a period of time between 1963 and 1967 where they gave what we call a dead virus vaccine, and that didn't seem to work as well. And so right now it's a live virus vaccine. So we've gotten calls about that. You know, we try and educate people. I send out information to physicians and to school nurses and whoever else wants information because it has been in the news so prominently lately.
Yeah. Do we have any idea how many unvaccinated kids we have in our schools? Is that documented?
Yes. Yes, it is. And it depends on the age group. So we are anywhere with the smaller children of 50% of them are vaccinated up to when they get into kindergarten, it's about 90% are vaccinated. So that's 90% is pretty much our cutoff. We go below 90% and that's when we're going to start seeing that the herd immunity is not protecting those who are not vaccinated. So.
Okay. Does the health department offer the vaccine?
Yes, we offer vaccines for children, which is a special program that if somebody doesn't have insurance or if they have Medicaid, they can come in and get the vaccine either if they're uninsured for $10 a shot or if they really can't afford to pay for it, we give it to them for free. We also have adult vaccines and we do bill many insurances, but they can call the office beforehand to see if their insurance will pay us.
Okay. Do you know the number off the top of your head?
Yes. 435-333-1500.
Okay. Anything else you'd like people to know about this?
No, I think we've really covered it. You know, babies, pregnant women, and immunocompromised people are the ones who are at the highest risk. So, you know, I encourage parents who don't have their children vaccinated or who are younger and have only had one dose to watch and just be aware. Check out where you're traveling. There's numerous outbreaks in California right now. And, you know, with kids, we're getting towards the end of the school year. Be careful. Check out on the CDC's website where the outbreaks are in the United States before you travel. If your children aren't immunized, you might be wise to change your plans.
Okay. Hey, Carolyn, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Carolyn Rose is a nurse with the Summit County Health Department.